This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and here's something I realized this week. So often, this program is about looking back, looking way back into World War II with the men and women who experienced it firsthand. But every so often, we get to look forward with the veterans who share their stories here, and every once in a while, there's the opportunity to share an update. In the extreme cases, we're able to tell you about vets who reconnected with someone they'd wondered about for decades, or maybe they were finally awarded medals they earned long ago. Today, we're going to have an update to the story of Bill Barrett, who remains on the docent staff at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado. Bill was one of three brothers who all served in World War II. 77 years ago, he was a 23-year-old Signal Corps communications expert heading to New Guinea.
December 5th of 42, we left Australia. Our company occupied the first hold of the ship, a makeshift ladder to go up and down, and we had to sleep on the floor. It took 6 days to reach our destination.
So then you get to New Guinea.
Right.
And you're going to spend the next year and a half there?
Yes, from December 42 to May of 44.
So you must have gotten used to it.
Oh, yeah. But I spent about three different areas.
Uh-huh.
We were at near Port Moresby, at Milne Bay, and at Ora Bay.
And what kind of work were you doing?
Communications. We were the first telephone exchange, American telephone exchange in New Guinea.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Can you give us a sense of the nature of these communications? Are you aware of what's being communicated all the time?
On some of them. We had to send a lot of reports back to headquarters at the end of the day. That's where it kept us busy most of the night. That's where we saved the routine messages for that communication that went back to headquarters. We knew some of the things that were going to happen during the war, maybe knew what was going to happen, but we didn't know exactly where or when.
Now you're talking about like invasions, islands?
Landings and stuff like that.
Yeah. Is that hard to think about when you know something like that's going to happen? I mean, do you think about those young men who are going to be crashing onto those beaches?
Oh, sure you do, yeah. You think about them, worry about them, and wonder how many of them's going to survive.
Yeah. And how about the role of communications in general? I mean, what would have happened if those messages that you're receiving and sending don't get through?
I don't know.
Probably would have cost some people some lives, right?
It could have, yeah, yeah.
So this is an important job.
Yeah, it was really. And then before we end this, I would like to make a couple of comments on what some messages or some receipts we got about our that we did in the war.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is after I finished this book. This is how I ended it.
All right.
I was not wading the shore at Omaha Beach. I was not fighting the enemy across the fields and towns of France and Germany. I was not flying in an airplane bombing the cities of Europe, or flying a fighter plane escorting our bombers, or shooting down enemy planes. I was not fighting in the jungles of New Guinea, or storming a beach of some island in the South Pacific. I was not one of the 400,000 that never made it back home. However, the 912 Signal Company I was assigned to had a significant role in the war in the South Pacific.
All right. You then got us interested, Bill.
Yeah. And then here's something else that was written about us. I won't read this whole thing, but I'll read part of it.
All right.
The supply of the final equipment and the operation of communications for all the units of General George C. Kennedy's 5th Air Force in New Guinea was the mission of the 912 Signal Company. In conjunction with the 27th Air Depot Group, the organization was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for Outstanding Merited Service and Achievement during the Papuan Campaign. The model signal depot established by the 912 Signal Company at Port Moresby has become the criterion upon which all other Signal Corps units of the Far East Air Force have been set up. From the 13th of December 1942 to 25th of April 45, when the unit left Port Moresby to set up a signal depot in the Netherlands New Indies, the 912 Signal Company has played a significant part in turning back the Japanese and in hoping to help make the eventual doom of the Japanese Empire.
So they said, you guys are the standard.
Yeah.
Your
right.
signal company. That's how they want them all to work.
That's right.
So what are some of these messages that you guys are transmitting that were so important that led them to write that about you?
Well, we had a few secret messages. Never did have a top secret message. Being we belonged to the 27th Air Depot Group, their primary purpose was getting airplanes back into flying. After, of course, they had to build all their buildings and everything because we went into a valley they called Death Valley, is where we were set up.
Mm-hmm.
It was right across the hill from the airstrip. Ward's Drome, and which I understand Ward's Drome is still there also.
Huh.
The message we mostly sent was like the, well, take one of the units that worked on airplanes, and at the end of the day they had to report on what progress they made, how soon that aircraft was going to be back flying condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then every unit more or less had to send back something they their report for the day to back to MacArthur headquarters in Australia. And that was a part of our job to do that.
Speaking of MacArthur,
yeah.
I understand you got somewhat close to him on at least one occasion.
I got a picture of him, but never got very close. They wouldn't let us get close to him. But
where was that?
It was in New Guinea at Port Moresby the day he came up to decorate Bong for his achievement.
Ah, well, we're going to have to tell the Dick Bong story then. Before we get to that, you did mention, and you downplayed it, but for most of us, Bill, we haven't lived through an air raid. We haven't been on a military base and heard the warning and tried to figure out how in the world you're going to stay safe when you have no idea if these bombs are going to land anywhere near you.
Right.
How frequent was that you guys would have an air raid?
Well, I don't know how frequent, but they went on for about 8 months before they stopped.
And how do you know it's happening?
You usually hear a siren. We would be over the hill from the airstrip. We'd hear sirens, and then the lights would go on, the searchlights. And then eventually you could see it. When they pick up the planes, you could see the planes up in the air.
So this is nighttime.
Nighttime, yeah.
The planes are coming. The searchlights are going off. And where are you?
In a pup tent.
In a pup tent.
Well, at first. The very first night we got into Port Moresby, we had an air raid.
Very first night.
Very first night.
Welcome to Port Moresby,
yeah.
Bill.
Yeah. So all we could do was just stand there and look.
And what do you see?
We had set up our pup tent. Well, you see the planes in the searchlights.
You see bombs coming out of the planes?
You couldn't see them, no, but you could hear them after they hit.
How close did they hit to where you were?
Just over the hill at the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
One night later on, a plane did sneak in behind one of our airplanes and drop some bombs, and one of them landed in a theater area. And it just happened that the movie had been over for a few minutes, so there were a few kids still hanging around, and some of them were killed. In fact, we lost three kids from our outfit that night.
From your company?
From our company, yeah.
And a couple things here. So if it had been 5 minutes earlier, you would have lost a lot.
Lost a lot of people, yeah.
Were you in the theater?
No, I did not go that night.
Did you usually go?
I went to a lot of theaters because that's about the only thing there was to do at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't you go that night?
I have no idea. I might have been working.
It's okay,
possible,
sure.
It's possible I could have been working that night.
And the young men who were killed, did you know any of them?
I know all three of them because they were in my communications.
So you'd spent quite a lot of time with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was that for you to deal with?
It was pretty hard to miss them. Especially one of them in particular was a very intelligent gentleman, a very nice gentleman, and had a lot of stories to tell, and he was really a character, and everybody enjoyed him, and we really missed him.
Did that kind of change the tenor of your company after that?
I don't think so, no.
Did you ever feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me, too?
That's possible, very possible, yeah.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, you take it as it came. If you got hit, you got hit.
So obviously that was the closest.
That was the closest I ever came in. Usually we were it was probably a couple of miles over to the airstrip. That's where they had most of their bombing range was on the airstrip. And it just happened this one night, this Japanese plane came in under the radar following one of our planes in, and he hit one of the warehouses, and I think he dropped three bombs, in the warehouse, one was in a little area, and then this one that landed in the theater area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you lost three guys, and on a lesser note, you probably didn't have any movies to watch for a while.
Well, there's several movie places around the area.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to go to a bunch of you want to go to a movie, you go to the motor pool, and they'd give you a truck to go to the movies.
And you also got to see a few movie stars out there.
I did see a few movie stars, yeah.
You guys had a few USO crews come through,
yeah,
or what?
Yeah, USO crews, yeah.
Tell me about it. What were those like?
Interesting, funny. We saw Joey Brown, who was the funniest guy you ever saw. I don't know how many people remember Joey Brown, but he was a very good comedian, and I think that's the hardest I ever laughed the night that we had him. It was funny. I don't know whether you know anything about Joey Brown, but he had a big mouth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Joey Brown did, and a lot came out of that big mouth.
A lot of GI humor there, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And Jack Benny came
through?
Saw
Jack Benny, Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Bob Hope, and there's probably some more I can't recall.
Yeah, well, those are some pretty big names.
Yeah, big names, yeah.
What did that mean to you to have these big names from Hollywood coming all the way to the other side of the world to be there for you guys.
Well, you really appreciate that, what they went through to do that. A lot of them went through some air raids and stuff like that, too, to put on these shows for us.
Sure. You said the air raid thing again, so I'm just wondering. I don't think I asked you this. Were you ever scared over there?
Oh, yeah, sure. When they start dropping those bombs, you never know where they're going to go.
And I imagine, too, in the messages that you're receiving and sending out, the nature of some of those messages had to do with casualties and losses. Did you have a sense of how the war was going?
Pretty much so. Being in communications, you knew we could get news out of Australia and stuff like that.
So you knew that momentum was heading in the right direction?
Yes.
And when I asked you about MacArthur, you brought up the name Bong. I'm sure a lot of your visitors here at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum know who Dick Bong was.
A lot of them don't.
Well, you get to educate them then, right?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of them about it and showed them the pictures that I have. Yeah.
So tell me how this all developed. You guys were actually sending the message that the record for the most aerial victories had been broken?
No, we knew, I forget how, but we do know that he broke this record.
Yeah, so Dick Bong was a P-38 pilot in the Pacific.
Right.
And the record for kills in aerial combat was held for a long time by Eddie Rickenbacker
in
from
World War One. World War One, yeah.
But Bong ends up breaking it in his P-38.
Yeah, by shooting down 27 enemy plane. Rickenbacker did 26.
So Bong gets his 27th.
Right.
You guys hear about it.
Right. And so a couple of days later, some of my friends and I went over to the airstrip to see if we could find his plane, and we were lucky enough to find it. And I happened to have my camera with me. I got a picture of his plane, the whole plane. I got a picture of the 27 flags painted on the side of the fuselage. Mm-hmm. And then I have a picture of me and one of my buddies sitting on the wing of his plane.
It's a great picture. I'm going to put that up at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wonder how many people have a picture like that, Bill.
Not very many, I don't think. Yeah. On the plane, yeah.
Did you have to ask anybody's permission?
No, there wasn't anybody there but the three of us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, wasn't anybody around the plane at all that day.
And he wasn't done.
Oh, no, he ended up doing 40.
How amazing is that?
Yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
So he breaks the record, and then MacArthur's coming to Port Moresby to congratulate him.
To congratulate him, yeah.
And you were there?
I was there. Well, this was the same day that we saw the plane.
Uh-huh.
And around one of the, we call them a revetment? Uh-huh. Revetment, yeah. There was a bunch of people standing, and one of the guys come over and talked to us. He must have been one of the photographers or reporters or something. He said, if you guys want to stick around a while, they'll make with your time. But they wouldn't let us get very close.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we kind of had to set up on the top of the revetment. And pretty soon the plane came in, and MacArthur came out of it. And I didn't get a picture of him. But so far away, you couldn't hardly tell who it was, except he was a little bit taller than everybody else. And somehow I lost that picture. I don't know what happened to it.
But you still have the memory.
I still have the memory of seeing him, yeah.
And that must have been kind of exciting.
It was, yes. Sure was.
But you left there in mid-1944.
Right.
Where'd you go?
Biak Island.
Tell us about that.
Biak Island is a small island off the coast of New Guinea. I don't know how far. Took us a few days to get up there on another ship. There, our camp was right next to the there was the airstrip. Road and then our camp.
Uh-huh.
So we saw a lot of planes coming and going. And
did you ever talk your way into a ride on any of those planes?
Never. Well, I'll take that back. I had one furlough to Australia and begged to ride on a C-47 down. Coming back, we went out to the airport to see when it was time to go back to, this is to New Guinea, got a ride on a Catalina, which is a boat that lands on water oars.
Yeah.
Or land, and I was hoping we'd land on water, but they didn't. And I also got to ride on a PT boat.
What was the occasion for that?
Off the island of Biak, there was a PT boat installation, and a friend of mine that I knew back in Kansas was a pharmacist mate over there. And he came over to Biak once in a while, picked up supplies and stuff, and I got to know him, that he was there. And he came by once or twice to see me when he came into town. So one night, I took time off and went and rode over with him and stayed all night with him and rode back the next morning, both times on a PT boat.
Were you ready to drop some depth charges?
No. Pretty fast, though.
Yeah, they were.
It went pretty fast, yeah.
And what about the living conditions on Biak? Was that different compared to
about the same. We were in tents all the time. Eventually, we got lighting and flooring in them. Mostly, part of the time, they just had the dirt floor. We were never in the barracks all the time while I was overseas.
Never in the barracks?
Never in the barracks.
More than 3 years over there.
Yeah.
So why don't you live in a cabin in the woods or something, Bill?
Well, I like it.
in town too well.
Uh-huh. And, talked to a lot of guys who experienced those conditions. A lot of them ended up with tropical diseases, malaria, other things.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any issues with that?
Well, no, I never had, but they made us take a malaria pill every day.
Uh-huh.
When you went through the chow line, there was a guy at the end of the chow line that gave you a malaria pill, and he made sure that you took it.
What would you say was the hardest thing to deal with over there?
Probably being away from home.
Especially when things happen at home that you can't do anything about. 16 million Americans were away from home serving our country all over the world in World War II. There are fewer than 400,000 of them still living today. And in Colorado, that number is under 6,000. But 100-year-old Bill Barrett is one of them. You'll hear more of his World War II memories, plus an update on why this month was so special for him when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.